what does planetary health have to do with occupational therapy? In this one-hour CEU course, we'll review an article in which the authors contend that engagement with environmental sustainability is foundational for our OT profession. Their goal is to help OT students and professionals translate environmental awareness to practical action. They believe that three skills can close the theory-practice gap: clinical reasoning, bidirectional questioning, and interprofessional education. To help us dive even deeper into this topic, we are so excited to have Moses Ikugo, PhD, OTRL, FAOT, join us on the podcast after we review this article. Dr. Ikugo is a pioneer in connecting OT practice to global health, and he'll share how studying planetary health has influenced his work as an OT educator. And as always, we'll bring it back to how this research can help improve your daily practice. So let's dive in. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we review new and influential OT journal articles, then pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Lyon, OTRL. And before we dive into this big topic of planetary health and OT, I wanted to let you know that this podcast may count as continuing education for you. You are probably listening to this podcast on a free platform, but to gain CEU credit, you will need to be a member of the OT Potential Club, our OT evidence-based practice platform. As of this recording, it is just $89 to join us in the club, so I highly suggest that you join us in there. But bearing in mind that this could count as a CEU course, I wanted to state our two learning objectives so you can be thinking about them throughout the podcast today. Our first learning objective is that you will be able to recognize the components of environmental reasoning, a form of clinical reasoning to be taught to novice OTs. Our second learning objective is you will be able to identify the components of bidirectional questioning, a skill that was proposed to be taught to OT students. So let's begin by looking at our journal article, and then we'll bring Moses onto the podcast. The title of our article today is Moving from Theory to Practice in Occupational Therapy, Education for Planetary Health, a Theoretical View. It comes to us from the Australian Occupational Therapy Journal and was published in 2023. And I did want to mention that this article came to be on our podcast because on our most cited OT journal articles list, which we draw articles from, there was a planetary health article, but it was from 2019 and really short. So I went and found a more up-to-date article for us to review and discuss. So this article begins with this big picture introduction to what is planetary health. Planetary health is a combination of two factors: the health of human civilization and the health of essential natural systems. What this ultimately means is that human health depends on planetary health. And unfortunately, human occupations have altered water, land, and ecosystems. This has led to widespread degradation of the natural environment. If we do not want our health to suffer as a consequence of this environmental degradation, we have an urgent need to transform human values and practices. These calls have come from many entities, including the Glasgow Climate Pact from the United Nations and Building Climate Resilient Health Systems from the World Health Organization. So what does this call for considering planetary health have to do with occupational therapy? At its core, OT considers people, environments, and occupations. This orientation naturally makes us notice the link between what people do and their own surroundings. And that awareness uniquely positions OT professionals to promote sustainable occupations. Sustainable occupations can support global efforts to combat climate change while addressing related lifestyle diseases. Indeed, it has been argued that engagement in environmental sustainability is fundamental to the achievement of our professional purview. I'll share two articles in the show notes that expand on this. One is a 2015 article called Occupational Therapy and Environmental Sustainability, and one is a 2020 article called Occupation and Environmental Sustainability, a Scoping Review. So from here, the authors introduce planetary health, and OT education. Multiple papers have been written about introducing planetary health content into medical education. Again, I'll link to these in the show notes, but two examples are I Teach It Because It Is the Biggest Threat to Health, a 2020 article, and Fulfilling a New Obligation, Teaching and Learning of Sustainable Healthcare in the Medical Education Curriculum. That's from 2019. But that being said, such papers have primarily been aimed at medical doctors. Allied health's role in planetary health is just beginning to be explored. And at this point, literature on exactly how to embed it environmental sustainability into curricula is scarce, which leads us to this paper. So what was the purpose of this paper? This theoretical paper aimed to contribute to the conversation around translating awareness of planetary health to practical action. To do so, the authors sought to provide transferable skills for occupational therapy education. Three practical skills are suggested as a means to close the theory-practice gap. The skills incorporate educational processes supporting the transition from novice to expert health practitioner. I'm going to walk through these three skills at a pretty high level and begin with number one, environmental and sustainable clinical reasoning. As was outlined in the book, Clinical and Professional Reasoning in Occupational Therapy, there are multiple forms of clinical reasoning within our profession. These already include pragmatic clinical reasoning, narrative, ethical, and scientific. In this vein, the authors propose two additional forms of clinical reasoning, environmental reasoning and sustainable reasoning. Environmental reasoning is a form of novice clinical reasoning, and I'm just going to go ahead and read the description that they have here in the paper for you. It says that environmental reasoning is a foundational form of reasoning whereby the therapist assesses the environmental cost of a proposed intervention. When applying environmental reasoning, the therapist explicitly considers the impact of all forms of resources required from the perspective of the potential carbon footprint, thinking through the lens of reduce, reuse, and recycle. And then sustainable clinical reasoning is for the expert practitioner. This has a slightly longer description, so I'm just going to read the first part of it. I think that will serve our purposes today. So the article states that sustainable reasoning is an advanced form of reasoning whereby the therapist assesses the cost of the proposed intervention from three discrete perspectives, environmental, social, and financial, and consolidates costs along the triple bottom line. And that triple bottom line being people, planet, and profit. The authors state that embedding this environmental and sustainable reasoning into OT curricula may help us adhere to the guidelines set by the World Federation of Occupational Therapy in their document Sustainability Matters, Guiding Principles for Sustainability in Occupational Therapy Practice, Education, and Scholarship. And so I know our guest today was an author on this guideline, so we'll definitely be talking about that in just a little bit. So the second skill that the authors propose is bidirectional questioning. Historically, occupational therapy has focused on the individual in both theory and practice. We know this as person-centered care. Yet the simplistic worldview can neglect the interconnectedness of society, as well as how humans interact with nature. For example, health promotion efforts often focus too much on individual responsibility versus societal issues. Indigenous knowledge, on the other hand, reminds us of the interconnectedness of all things. To incorporate this knowledge into OT practice, the authors recommend the concept of two-eyed seeing, which they describe as learning to see from one eye with the strengths of indigenous knowledge and the ways of knowing, and from the other eye with the strengths of Western knowledges and the ways of knowing, and then using both of these eyes together for the benefit of all. Bidirectional questioning, then, is a practical manifestation of two-eyed seeing. It is a two-way analysis that removes the single individual as the focal point of care. Instead, it asks not only about individual participation, but how this participation impacts the environment. It also acknowledges the reciprocity between human health and environmental health. Put simply, bidirectional questioning asks, what does the individual need, and what does the world need from the individual? And the third skill that they recommend is interprofessional collaboration. Interprofessional learning has come to be viewed as an essential part of healthcare students' training. The authors propose that when OT learners are provided with opportunities for interprofessional learning, either university or placement-based, they should be prompted to explicitly seek opportunities for sustainable learning. In this section, the authors keep citing an article called Building an Environmentally Accountable Medical Curriculum Through International Collaboration. So I'll link to that in the show notes for more details about what this interprofessional collaboration could look like. So headed into the discussion, this paper suggests that OT education should encourage students to develop environmental reasoning as novices. This would then evolve into sustainability clinical reasoning as they become experts. Sustainable clinical reasoning, bidirectional questioning, and interprofessional collaboration could equip students to make contributions to sustainable quality healthcare. This sustainable quality healthcare has the potential to maximize gains, minimize cost and environmental harm, and take advantage of every opportunity to add social value. So that is our article breakdown. There is obviously a lot to unpack there, and I'm so, so thankful to be joined today by our guest, Dr. Moses Ikugo, PhD, OTRL, FAOTA, Professor of Occupational Therapy at the University of South Dakota. Moses received a diploma in occupational therapy from Kenya Medical Training College in Nairobi, a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology and master's degree in counseling psychology from the United States International University in San Diego, and then a PhD in occupational therapy from Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas. Dr. Ikugo has been an occupational therapist for 37 years with clinical experience in mental health, long-term care, and subacute rehabilitation. Moses practiced for 5 years as a psychological counselor working with individuals and families. His research interests include investigation of the philosophical foundations of occupational therapy theory development and application, use of knowledge derived from occupational science to help address environmental sustainability problems and other pertinent social issues. Understanding the construct of meaningfulness as used in occupational therapy and occupational science, and lastly, investigating the status of evidence for evidence-based practice using meta-analysis. Moses is currently conducting a research study within an interdisciplinary team involving computer and materials scientists at SDSU and South Dakota School of Mines to investigate ways of using occupation-based interventions to prepare astronauts so that they will be able to stay healthy during lengthy deep space exploration. Moses is the immediate past leader of the WFOT International Project Team that published the document Sustainability Matters, Guiding Principles for Sustainability in Occupational Therapy Practice, Education, and Scholarship. This document articulated the 5 principles to guide incorporation of sustainability topic in occupational therapy, scholarship, and practice. As you can hear from that bio, I definitely feel like we found the right person to talk to about this article. So I'm so thankful Moses is here today, and I will patch him into this podcast. Welcome to the podcast, Moses. It's great to have you.
Very nice to be here, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me.
I am so thankful you're here. I'm so thankful to be talking about this topic. When I think of planetary health, I know that there can be dissension and different opinions on certain climate policies and things like that. But when I think of caring for the environment, every person that I know cares for the environment, and I think all OTs do. And this paper really opened my eyes into how we can be integrating that part of ourselves into our work. So I'm just thankful to be talking about it today. But before we get there, I want to start with learning a little bit more about you and your story and start with how you first found OT.
Well, thanks, Sarah, for asking that. I was born in Little Village on the northern slopes of Mount Kenya in Kenya, East Africa. And we were in British colony until 1963 when we got independent. So I was born actually a couple of years before my country got independence. During the colonial times, people had been moved to reservations, including my family. So when independence came, the government had to resettle people. And so we got a piece of land right on the slopes of Mount Kenya at the edge of the Meru forest, which is part of the Mount Kenya forest. So I remember having a child where there was a lot of rain, very rich land, nice pastures, vegetation that was really clean and nice. Land was very fertile and people could sustain themselves in it. But then it started changing. So in 1975, we had the first drought in my lifetime. Now, anyone who has grown up in the farm knows that that can be scary when the crop fails, especially for people who are dependent on the land. So I became very sensitized about changes and about crop failures and droughts, but no one could really explain what was happening. And so I was struggling with this until the 1990s when I came to the U.S. and then started reading more broadly and started looking at climate change, and then suddenly everything made sense. And so I started working on occupational therapy and the climate change. Getting into occupational therapy itself was kind of by chance. I didn't know what it was. I wanted to study psychology, but we didn't have a major of that in Kenya. So my sister, who was in college, the same college at the time, suggested I try occupational therapy. She knew they studied in psychology. So that's how I ended up in occupational therapy. So when I learned climate change, it occurred to me that a lot of the cause of climate change, as in described by the IPCC, can be attributed to human occupations. And so then my question is, why are we as occupational therapists and scientists not involved? It seems like a natural fit. And so that's how I got started on this topic.
Wow, I love hearing how, for you, it sounds like occupational therapy and planetary health were so melded from the beginning, because that was a melded part of your experience. It seemed like you were maybe extra aware growing up, like having those things on your radar and thinking really critically about that, then bringing that to your occupational therapy experience. So you enter into the OT field. I know that you have been a part of multiple papers related to occupational therapy and climate change. How did you start making those connections, and how did that interest become more explicit for you, where you actually started writing about it?
So when I started thinking that occupational therapy may have something to offer in this area, because, you know, things people do, whether pursuing productive occupations or leisure or self-care, it seemed to me these are the things that are causing environmental damage and the climate change. And then while I was thinking about that, I learned the work of a scientist who was really not very popular at the time, James Lovelock, who wrote a paper with Margulis back in the 1990s, actually earlier, and suggested that the earth has self-regulation. It behaves like a living organism. It regulates its own weather, and it seems to be like a human being would regulate the breathing and all those other things. And so he suggested that this organism was sick because of the activities of the human beings. We have become like a virus that is affecting this system negatively. But if it fails, we fail. because we are dependent on it. And so this got me thinking, if the earth is an organism and it is sick, then occupational therapists and the scientists are the healers of the earth. So that's how we should be involved. And so that is when I started exploring the topic and writing. And because I could not publish a peer-reviewed paper on it at the time, I wrote a small book, Occupational Science in the Service of Gaia, where I suggested that occupational therapists and the scientists are the physicians who should work to heal the sick in Gaia, as Lavrock referred to it. And so I started then looking at how they could do this, and that is where my work on this started. At the same time, I've always been interested in theory, and so I had already developed a theoretical framework based on what I considered to be the philosophical foundations of OT that I called instrumentalism in occupational therapy. So I decided to modify that a little bit to apply to this topic. And then I started doing research on it.
It's so interesting to hear about how your mind was integrating all these things that you were learning about. And it sounded like it started with just coming from yourself, but then so many people have come along on this journey. I'm curious how like relationships and collaborations came out of that. Did you start to meet people who were thinking in a similar way? What did those early stages look like? Did it feel like you were alone in the endeavor, or did you quickly meet people who were thinking the same way as you?
Well, when I wrote the book, I wasn't very sure anyone was gonna really read it.
Yeah,
and so the first time I realized it was noticed when I got an invitation by Mark Anson and Mami Aoyama, who at the time were at the University of West Kyushu. And the university was holding a conference on environmentalism and sustainability. And so they asked me whether I would go and provide a keynote, and at the same time provide a keynote on the same topic at the Japanese Society of Occupational Science. They were having their conference the same time. So, of course, I accepted and I went and I did that. And then when I came back, I was invited by Ben Whitaker to consider the possibility of joining the WFOT sustainability team. And so then I joined the sustainability team and started working through that. And then through that work, of course, the number of collaborators started increasing continuously.
It's so humbling to come to a topic like this. Like for me, to be perfectly honest, I'm thinking about OT and planetary health together explicitly for the first time. And it's so humbling to think about all the work and all the thought that's gone into this area now over decades. So I'm thankful for your work and for all of the all that's been written for us to draw from. It's already such a rich field to dive into, and I can see it just continuing to grow so much. So you've been a part of these collaborations, you've been writing, you've been thinking about this. One of the things I wanted to ask about right away was, in your teaching role, in OT. How does all this come into the classroom for you? Like, is it a module? Is it integrated throughout? Like, what's the, how does this part of your work show up in the classroom?
Actually, it started as research. When I started formulating this in theoretical terms, I decided to do research to validate that occupational therapy could have an effect. And so using the model, the modified instrumentalism in OT, I started recruiting students, faculty, and staff into the research. And then through that, we would have a series of sessions, basically based on my book, The Occupational Science in the Service of Gaia, and we would discuss each topic, and then I would collect both quantitative and qualitative data to see how people were changing. So many of the students I was teaching got exposed to that, and really they were very receptive. And then some of them came back to teach. Like now the chair of the OT, the current chair of the OT department, who is assuming the chair position beginning Friday, was my student and my advisee. And so when they started teaching, then they started inviting me to give lectures in their classes. Like this particular person who is now going to be the chair has been teaching a course that is the social determinants of health, and regularly invites me to give a lecture on sustainability. Then that's how it got integrated in the occupational therapy curriculum, through these individual lectures on these kinds of courses that deal with more complex issues like social determinants of health. So that is how it's been integrated in our curriculum. Sometimes we give public lectures. There is another lady who teaches in the earth sciences, and sometimes we will give a public lecture together with the students as the audience.
Wow, I just love how you're living out what this article talked about. And I'm so excited for your students that they get this exposure so early in their OT journey. I think if I had heard this as a student, I think I would have really latched on, and I think it would have changed how I thought about OT moving forward. So I'm thankful for this new generation who is getting this information so much earlier. And I can just see how it integrates so easily into their understanding of occupational therapy, and how that's going to change their thinking moving forward. I like this article a lot because it gave some just like specific examples of how planetary health could be showing up in OT education. But like I said, I'm looking at this from just like a hypothetical view. So I was curious just what your impressions were of this article as someone who's way more steeped in this area and someone who's actually been living it out more.
Actually, I liked the article a lot. They offer some very good ideas. For instance, they draw from the work of other environmentalists, like the triple bottom line, that suggests that we need to look at the social, environmental, and the economic factors that have to do with sustainability. And I think that kind of aligns with my thinking a lot, because that is how I was looking at the issue. I was looking at the issue as a complex, and so I was using complexity theory. And my argument was that in complexity theory, it says that if there are small differences in input, those can result in huge differences in outcome. So based on complexity theory, if, for instance, you instruct a few students in the mechanics of climate change and how human occupations can change that, you never know what the effect will be. You can have very huge differences in the effects. And so that is my starting line, which includes all those, because then my other argument was that you can't solve the issue of climate change by itself. You have to look at, it's a complex issue. And if you really want to solve it, you have to look at all the other related issues, like poverty. You know, if people are poor, they're not going to start looking at solutions to solve the environmental issues. They are trying to survive. But in order to solve the issue of poverty, you have to look at issues of health. If people are in poor health, they tend to become poorer and so forth. But then in order to do that, you have to look at issues of governance. Corrupting governments are not likely to be able to do much to move this issue forward. But in all that, you also have to look at population growth, because if the population grows beyond the current capacity of the earth, it doesn't matter what else we do, we'll still be in trouble. So you have to look at all these issues together. And you can't look at any of them in isolation, which is basically the triple bottom line approach, right? You have to look at all those together. But I also like the way they propose, the solution they propose. Now, they are looking particularly at the education of students, and they are looking at, clinical reasoning, how to introduce environmental issues as part of the clinical reasoning, and then what they call bi-directional questioning, which is about getting away from trying to satisfy the individual needs, but looking at the other more collective issues, which, by the way, it's very consistent with my culture where I grew up, because no one could meet their needs if you ignored the more collective needs. And of course, then finally the interprofessional education. So they have a very good approach with which I agree. The only thing I would add to that is what I call theoretical theoretical reasoning, because that is, I believe that all occupational therapy shouldn't be theory-based and evidence-based. So you can't really leave the theory out. And that is the theoretical reasoning wouldn't be the only other thing I would add to what they propose. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you have added back in like that complexity theory that you were talking about?
I think any theory can be modified to address this issue. My theory works on this because I believe that, in essence, human beings want to do the right thing. As Viktor Frankl suggested, what we are facing in the modern era is the problem of meaninglessness. And that is what has to be healed, because meaninglessness actually causes health issues and it can cause even things such as depression and suicide and so forth. But then when you look at what we deal with, we are supposed to be dealing with that very issue, right? And so my suggestion is that what is more meaningful than doing something that would ensure the survival of future generations. That seems to me like the ultimate meaning, right? And so in my theoretical model, I propose that people start, and that is the research we were doing that was published in 2015, you start with a statement, a personal mission statement that clarifies what legacy you want to create with your existence. And then that legacy focusing specifically on these global issues, environmental damage, poverty, and all those other things. And then from that, think about how your daily occupational performance tends to affect those issues. And then think, how can I change my lifestyle in order to make it more likely to create that legacy that I desire? And so that is how I approach it. It's from this particular theoretical model. But I think all the theories in OT understand that the environment is a context within which occupations occur. So you can't ignore the environment. So any of them can actually be used to guide this process.
I love how expansively you're talking about things, and that just aligns with my experience of this article. It made me think so much more expansively about what we're doing and connect so many different parts of our lives. I love how you're talking about meaning making. I was thinking, as a business owner, I think of people, planet, profit for my business, but I hadn't really connected that to OT, and I love how this article does that so explicitly. I want to get into asking you specific questions about the 3 points that they had, but before we did that, I wanted to ask one more big picture question related to the article. The authors talked about how there's this broad agreement about the urgency of tackling sustainability in OT education. And I was just curious from your perspective, if you see that broad agreement or if there's been dissent, and has that changed over your career? Just curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, there's been a big change. And I think now almost there's a lot of agreement that we need to do something about this. And I would credit that change to the younger people, the Gen Z and on, because they are very vocal about this issue, which is the right thing to do. When I started, of course, it was more difficult to get occupational therapists to see the relevance of this topic in their practice. And so it was an uphill battle. But it took a while. In the US, for instance, we didn't even articulate any position statement on the issue until this spring, when there was a task force was formed back in the fall to make recommendations, and then those recommendations were adopted by the RIA. So that is the very first step that the AOTA has taken, but it has taken quite some time to get there. But I think right now, of course, there's very few people who are unfortunately very vocal. they are the voices that tend to be heard. But I think at present, the majority of therapists do understand this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. It is an ethical as well as a health issue. And if the environment is the context within which occupations occur, if the environment is unhealthy, no meaningful occupations are possible. I think people understand that now.
Hearing that transition definitely gives me hope. Like, there's been a sea change since you've started. And I know it's been a lot of years and a lot of work, but the sea change has happened. And so when I project forward, I just see that accelerating. I see more and more people getting involved in this area and coming to their OT work with this lens in this context. I'm so inspired by our students always. So I wanted to ask just like really practical questions about the three parts of this article, the clinical reasoning, the bidirectional questioning, and interprofessional collaboration, and just kind of go through one by one and talk about what examples of them could look like for people, I guess, in traditional practice or other types of OT practice, and start with the clinical reasoning part, and probably at that novice level, what does that, they called it environmental reasoning. What can novice level clinical reasoning look like that has that environmental reasoning component? They called that just reduce, reuse, recycle. Like what can that look like in a really practical way for us?
I think it's a very practical, in a very practical way, you can say, okay, like here now, how do I reduce the things that can destroy the environment, like printing less and less on paper and using more electronic devices. I love that my students nowadays they don't have books. They even when they buy books, they buy the electronic publication, the electronic books, which is a huge help in reducing deforestation. So those are some of the things. Of course, there are small things like recycling and so forth. But then I think it has to go beyond that, beyond just learning how to recycle, reuse, and so forth, and go into other activities, like, for instance, advocacy. So, can people write to their representatives and pressure them to start doing something about this issue? In what I think it is Poland and colleagues who coined the term political activities of daily living. So when people do political activities of daily living, they can influence policy in the right direction. So those are some of the things they can do. But also before doing that, I think people need to understand what we are talking about. So they have to do reflection to figure out, how do I relate to the environment? What do I get from the environment? Okay, I get food, which is necessary for sustenance. But then, like today, it's so hot. What happens if there are no trees and you are walking outside and there is no shade? You know, things like that. What about resources that I need to participate in occupations? The rivers are kind of dying. So how does that work for people whose recreation is water-based activities, like boating and so forth? So reflecting on those things in order to make real connections between the environment and daily occupations. I think that should even come before recycle, reuse, and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah, that seems like a foundational first part to think about our own clinical reasoning, is thinking about our relationship to the topic. And I'm pretty sure that in the World Federation of OT Guiding Principles, I think there were reflection questions for OTs. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, so, okay. I will definitely link to those because that does feel foundational and a very just concrete step for us all to take.
And also in the consensus statement that was published recently by a team of international healthcare workers, in which I was fortunately involved, that is one of the major things that you have to start using the humanistic principles. You have to start with the sensitization of the students regarding this issue, and that starts with the reflection, but also encouraging them to just go out and be in the environment and physically get in touch with it so that they can appreciate that it's not apart from them. It's an extension of them.
That's a pretty great assignment to go spend some time outside.
Yeah, that's my students like that. But, you know, even when the weather is not so good, they want us to go and sit outside and discuss mm-hmm. things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I love how that relates to the part of our profession that's embracing nature-based therapy and taking, I see those as individuals who have that love of nature and are incorporating that into their therapy. I just love thinking about that as like an outlet for people and a possibility for really explicitly incorporating this into their OT practice. I wanted to ask about bidirectional questioning, or which relates to two-eyed seeing, which the article talked about seeing things from this Western lens, but also from an Indigenous perspective. I wanted to hear your thoughts on, I guess there are two separate concepts, and if you found them helpful, if you've encountered them before, and what some examples of using them could be.
Yeah, actually, the Indians articulated really express a term, but it's a very philosophical notion that, mm-hmm. you know, the duality, you want to respect the individual and the individual interests and needs, but then you also need to recognize that the collective mm-hmm. and the environment is part of the collective. And in practice, I always refer back to my own culture where I grew up. I come from the culture of an ethnic group known as the Mero people. And the Mero people have, at least when I was growing up, now it's very westernized, so it's different. But there was always that collective notion mm-hmm. that you have to be part of a community. You've learned of the Ubuntu philosophy, right? So that is basically that culture that you can't live like an island. You have to be part of the community. There's still something there. You know, if I go home, people will come knocking on the door. They won't give an appointment. They just come because it's what is expected. You are part of the community and you have no choice. You have to be part of it. But then the environment also belongs to everybody. So like, for instance, when I was growing up, no one could own the water sources. Even if the water passes by your land, if people need to draw water for their use, you can't tell them they are trespassing. They have to come and get the water. And then, of course, there was a lot of protection of the land and the marshlands and the forests through a lot of taboos because mm-hmm. they believed the spirits lived in these areas, in the forests, in the lakes. And so human beings have no business in going there to disturb the spirits because they can get very angry. And now I understand what those taboos were all about. It's to protect those collective resources so that they are there for everybody. I always give an example of the work of a fellow Kenyan who won a Nobel Prize for her work. Her name was Wangari Maathai, Professor Wangari Maathai, who started the Green Belt Movement. They ended up planting like 1,000 trees, and billion or something like that. And the way he would work with the people, he would go to the community. Now, in Kenya, the women tend to have the role of housekeeping and cooking and so, and they use wood, firewood. And so he would go and discuss with them and tell them, you have no source of firewood. So, because the forests are disappearing, so what can we do about it? And then they discuss and come to a consensus, we need to plant trees so that we have a source of firewood. And so that is how he started this. And then communities got together, started growing trees and so forth. That is actually something that OT can do. And if, I can't say I've trying to do it, because in a place like South Dakota, it might be challenging to start something like that. But it's not out of the possibility of OT practice to go and work with the communities to do this kind of work.
It's a big mind shift to think beyond person-centered care. Like that's what that's what I was taught, that very like individual focus, and that's what OT was. But I love this expansion of thinking of the interplay with the earth and with the community or the collective, and thinking about that explicitly in our occupational therapy encounters. Like in some ways it's a big leap, but it's also like, I think we all intuitively understand the interconnectedness of the individual and the community and the earth.
Because I think even here people do understand it. If you start looking at the history of the occupation of the West, the Mindy West and the West, people understood the yearn to stick together to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not really a foreign concept. I think it can be easily understood.
Yeah, I live in a small farming community, and there's definitely remnants of that way of thinking, where the community is so important and so essential that we need each other for sure. I wanted to ask about interprofessional collaboration. That was kind of the third pillar that the article talked about. And just ask examples of how OTs can be involved in this. I think your story kind of exemplifies that. But if you had other insights or stories to share on what that interprofessional collaboration can look like for OTs.
Well, I think this is where the work of the Association of Medical Educators of Europe could play a very big role, because that is what the consensus statement was all about. That this is not an issue that can be solved with one profession in isolation. So people have to work together, and in the education of students, interprofessional, this has to be done in the context of interprofessional education. Now, we haven't done much of that in occupational therapy, at least here in the U.S., because we are still trying to get into it. But I think it falls in the same, like right now in institutions, interprofessional education is a very big topic, because it was found that when you have people who know how to work together interprofessionally, there are less mistakes, healthcare mistakes, which induces mortality and other medical accidents. And so interprofessional education is very common now. So it would be very easy to bring the environment in. So OTs can help people, for instance, figure out how to change their lifestyles so that their lifestyles, their occupational lifestyles, are more consistent with a healthier environment as they continue to enjoy themselves and be productive and so forth. But then the pharmacist can think of, how do we produce medication in a way that is not wasteful and that protects the environment? And then when we have waste, how do we get rid of it responsibly? And those are all things that can be done in interprofessional coursework, where everyone talks about, how do I contribute to addressing this issue? And how do we support each other?
Yeah, I love thinking about OTs in that role. And I think about OTs working in some traditional settings for like big healthcare systems, and I hope they're raising their hand and being part of like the sustainability team. Like those efforts are out there for us to plug into already. And maybe if there isn't something in whatever setting you're in, I think that'd be a great thing for an OT to spearhead. I look at this topic that we're talking about today and it's so big, expansive. I'm like, it's the biggest topic that we've talked about on the podcast. And I wanted to be sure to ask you about what keeps you motivated and inspired in this work. You've been at it for so many years. What keeps you motivated and inspired?
I think it's necessity. Like I mentioned, I grew up in a place where we were sustained. I would not be here, for instance, if it was the way it is today, because we were coffee growers. We grew coffee and then we sold it. And that's how we got school fees. That's how I was able to get my education. And of course, with a lot of support from other sources. Now, where I grew up, coffee doesn't do very well anymore because it's too warm. Coffee likes more cooler weather. And so you can imagine there are a lot of generations that have lost out because they don't have money for things like education. And so for me, this is not a theoretical issue. It's a practical issue that actually affects family members and other people that I know very closely. And so because of that, I feel an obligation to do whatever I can to help. Mm-hmm. Plus, I do have a daughter and a son, and now I have grandkids, and I have to worry about what kind of world are they inheriting from us.
Yeah, one of the supplemental papers that I read ended with just this call for a more just and sustainable world and how that justice work and sustainability go hand in hand, I think, was one of my big takeaways from this paper and definitely a point of reflection for me.
Yeah, definitely. There is an environmentalist by the name of O.R.R. who talked a lot about this issue. And actually, I gave a keynote at a conference in South Africa where I discussed exactly that kind of issue, that this is not just an health, but it's also an ethical issue. Because actually, the people who are being affected the most are the people who have contributed the least to the problem. Hmm. Many of my relatives, like my nieces and nephews, until recently, they walked everywhere or on their bike. Now they have mountain bikes, many of them, so it's a little bit different. But they are the ones who are affected the most by this problem. And so that's an ethical issue. It's an issue of justice. It's an issue of, it violates the principle of non-malfeasance, because when you destroy people's livelihood, that is actually malfeasance, you know. So this, it's an issue that impacts a lot of the ethical principles.
I think you stated that so beautifully and gives us so much to reflect on and sit with and calls us to take action. And there's a lot of really concrete things that we can all do no matter where we're at in the occupational therapy field, whether we're educators or students or in a traditional practice.
Yeah.
And I, again, love that call out at the beginning where you talked about self-reflection and it starting there. This has been such a helpful conversation and walk through this paper. We're already at our rapid fire time. Are you open to a couple of quick questions at the end?
Oh, sure. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, let's do it. Finish this sentence for me. Occupational therapy is?
A profession, occupational therapy, is a profession whose focus is helping people maximize meaningful living through the routine occupations they choose to do every day.
Beautiful. What's a moment that you've had as an occupational therapist that you'll never forget?
Actually, that was a moment I was doing a summer job at the Bergen Regional Hospital in Switzerland, in Texas, just outside San Antonio. And I worked with a gentleman who had a spinal cord injury and been bedridden for at least 2 years. And we worked together, and he just wanted to be able to transfer, at least with mean assist, from bed to wheelchair so that he could go to live home with his wife. But he was told that that's not a possibility after 2 years of being bedridden. And so I told him, yeah, let's go on and try. And we kept going at it. And then eventually he was able to do it. He took a shower with me for the first time in 2 years. And you could have seen his face. It was unbelievable. So that meant the occupational therapy the most rewarding thing for me. Just looking at his face.
I love the incredible individual moments that we get to experience as therapists. But I love how this topic just ties us to also be thinking so big picture about our work and pushing us to consider it through this lens. We've talked about so many things in this hour. I was wondering, what's the final takeaway you want to leave people with?
I think the final takeaway for me is this. As occupational therapists, we've always known that the environment is important. We always talk about the person, occupation, and the environment. I think the takeaway is that the environment is the context that makes pursuit of meaningful occupations possible. So if we have an environment that is not healthy, then that invalidates all the work we are doing, because we can't really support people in pursuing their meaningful occupations in an unhealthy environment. So that makes this topic totally within the scope of occupational therapy. In fact, we have no choice. We have to engage with this issue actively if we are to live our values.
Well, Moses, this has been such a wonderful conversation. I'm so thankful to you and the work that you've done on this topic. And I'm excited to see how our profession moves forward with this, with all the students and new practitioners that are headed out to the field with this as foundational knowledge now. So thank you for your work, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me and for the great work you are doing. Thank you.
Wow, you all, it was just such an honor to hear from Moses today. I'm also going to link to a David Orr quote that Moses and I talked about after the recording stopped. It was so meaningful to me to just hear about how we've been inspired by similar thinkers over the course of our careers. And I also wanted to remind you, if you are interested in earning a certificate for your time today, what you are going to do next is head to otpotential.com, where you can sign in or sign up for the OT Potential Club. Once you get into the club, you can take a test and earn a certificate for your time today. And as always, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I hope this podcast helps you broaden your knowledge, tweak your practice, and stay evidence-based. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time.